Today we have the absolute pleasure of welcoming John Moss and Chris Smith to come and speak with us. This is the first doubleheader, folks. John and Chris both work at JA Consulting, a consultancy specializing in helping companies through sales, business development, change management, and so on, but with a true human focus. Both are leaders in their own right with seriously impressive corporate backgrounds, which I know they mentioned in the presentation, working with some of the world's largest companies. Particularly, they focus in the energy, government, and professional service sectors. Fun fact is that Chris was the first person to ever interview me for a job in the real world. And I'm proud to say that I did end up working alongside him for a short amount of time afterwards. Both John and Chris are people I really, really respect, both the experience and opinion of. John and Chris presented a version of this session at the marketing meetup this year, shortly before COVID struck. It was so good, I asked them to come back. The thing that struck me from the talk was that the lessons I learned were things that I'd never heard before. While I sit through and attend many talks, the theories they presented and the attitudes that John and Chris shared were things that I could put into practice the next day. This is the important thing about this session. We negotiate every day, whether we know it or not. Knowing how to navigate these kind of scenarios is an absolute superpower, but it's not something we examine often, even to the point of many folks I know being actively uncomfortable in these scenarios. John and Chris are here to help you today. And if you enjoy this session, we'll also be running an in-depth session later this month. You can find that on the Marketing Meetup website. It's going to be like a 4-hour session. This session, though, will be split into two. 30 minutes presentation and 30 minutes Q&A. Get your questions in now, because we'll be answering questions throughout the course of the presentation and then afterwards as well. So if you've got a question, you can wiggle your mouse. You'll see at the bottom it says Q&A. You can ask your questions right now about negotiation, about persuasion, get them in. And please use the thumbs up feature, because the way that I'm going to ask the questions is literally pick them up from the top. So if your question is the top one, then that's the one that we're going to be asking. Finally, I want to make sure to thank the sponsors. All of these have been unbelievable for these past 10 weeks. They've really kept this show on the road. And while I've been personally, you know, just like absolutely blessed to have so many people to say thank you from the community, honestly, I'd do it for free. I absolutely will. These people deserve so much credit. I won't go into depth here because they all are listed in the email that I'll send afterwards. But what I want to say is thank you to Pitch, Content Cal, Fiverr, Redgate, Cambridge Marketing College, Lido, Brand, Further, Third Light, Bravo, and Human. One ask, just thank them. In the follow-up email, their names are listed. It literally says, say thanks to Lyron, say thanks to Andy, and just go on their LinkedIn profile, send them a connection request, and say thank you. It'll make the world a difference. So that's the world's longest introduction, so far as I'm concerned. So Chris, John, welcome, and over to you guys.
Joe, thank you so much. Before I actually start our presentation, can I just try very quickly, Joe, to echo what you just said? I think, you know, it's a tough old world out there, and you know, the last few days have been particularly difficult for certain communities, and I think it's great that we all recognise that and maybe have some empathy with it.
Let me just echo John's comments. Joe, I thought that was an absolutely wonderful introduction. It was delivered from the heart, and I think everyone on this call empathizes with everything you said, so well done.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sweet. Okay, folks, I'm now going to share my screen. We've got a deck of material we're going to walk you through. If you do have any questions, just please, as Joe said, put them in the Q&A box or in the chat box. And Joe's going to control that sort of side of the process. And if you have any issues on hearing us or anything like that, yeah, please shout. So screen share coming up now. Right. Hopefully everybody can see it. I'm looking at Joe, and Joe's giving me the thumbs up. Thank you, Joe. So this conversation is called Negotiation and Persuasion for Marketeers. And looking at what Joe's been sending out, you are all probably going to have some expectation we're going to be talking a lot about negotiation. Well, we are, but we're actually going to be spending quite a lot of time talking about persuasion. And there's a reason for that. Is the most effective negotiators don't, basically. The most effective negotiators work really hard on persuasion. So we're going to be talking about us as JA Consulting, tell you a little bit about that. We won't bore our pants off you on that. Talk about what the persuasion job is, the buying journey and how that all works, the fundamental principles of resistance, and then lead into negotiation. So that's basically the structure that we've got. Tiny little bit about us. Joe did a really good job. I'm not sure if I can improve it, actually. Fundamentally, my whole career has been sales and marketing, all in the business-to-business environment. We run, a small group of us run a small consulting firm that's all about business development, account management, those sorts of things. I could go on talking about what I love doing for hours, but I'm not going to. Chris, why don't you say a few words about yourself?
Yes, and like last time, John, I will definitely keep it short because you told me off that last time I went on too long at the last marketing meetup. Like John, I've spent my entire career in sales and marketing. It's been spent in the IT and IT services industry. I used John at the same company that I recruited Joe in to help us improve the types and quality of commercial conversations we were having with our clients. We had a team of consultants who were very comfortable in having technical conversations, and we wanted to help them have a subtly different conversation, and one that was more business and commercially focused. And we used John Jay Consulting to help us on that journey. After a while of working for them, I won't bore into the detail, I came and joined John and have been doing this with John for the last 3.5 years.
Thank you very much, Chris. And I just saw a couple of the Q&A questions, and we'll see if we can pick those up as we go through. Now, one of the problems that those of you who present on Zoom will know is that sometimes the screen freezes, which means you have to reshare, which is what I've just done. So apologies about that. Just this picture just tells you something about the sort of people we work with. As I said, it's primarily business to business, almost exclusively for the last 10 years, it's been in a business to business environment. And you're going to see quite a lot of professional services firms in there. BP is our largest client. We also do quite a lot of work in the Ministry of Defence and other government agencies. So quite an interesting variety. One of the key themes about what we do is all around change. And a big part of change is how do you persuade people? So that's what I want to move to now. So this rather crude slide says the road to persuasion. So I want to introduce you to some fairly sophisticated, you're going to notice sarcasm in a minute, sophisticated models to really think about what persuasion is. So here's our sophisticated model number one. Persuasion is all about moving people from point A to point B. Now, I'm sure some of the marketers out there can make a much better fist of that slide than I do. But fundamentally, that's how we should be thinking about persuasion. We're trying to move people from one position to another position. Now, of course, it's a bit more complicated than that, isn't it? Because actually, there's almost always some sort of barrier, some sort of hill that we've got to get over. So I want to spend a bit of time just talking about what that really means, and therefore how can you avoid having a negotiation if you do the right persuasion job. So one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about is this thing that we call the buying journey. Some of you may have seen this, some of you may not. But fundamentally, what it is trying to do is to sum up how people buy. This particular model is based on really three key pieces of research, some work done by a chap called Neil Rackham, who's done a huge amount of research in this area. something called the Challenger Sales Opportunity, and some work that's also been done at Harvard. Let me just walk you through it quite quickly. So, and you'll see what we've done here is we've split it into marketing and sales. So I think you probably have some awareness about this. So stage one is pre-awareness and awareness, making sure that people are aware of what you're doing. Stage two is about education. And then moving more into the face-to-face, or maybe we'll never have face-to-face now, but in that direct contact, recognition of needs, seeing that people have got something that they want to do something about. And then there's a phase of consideration, thinking about whether this is a good idea, a phase of evaluation, and then into a decision, and then into delivery. And like a lot of models, and it's something that us consultants do, is we put these models together. Of course, it's really complicated and quite complex. And one of the things about this whole buying journey is people get stuck, and they get stuck in each phase and maybe just go round and round in circles. If you look at particularly the B2B environment and how that has evolved over the last 10 years, and different researchers seem to say different things, but fundamentally, there are now many, many more stakeholders involved in making a purchasing decision. Now, I'm going to pause for a second there, because I'm referring very much into what I guess we'd all think of as a very traditional business environment. I think the same is true about persuasion in our personal lives. Social media has exposed us to a lot more conversations, and more people are influencing those decisions and influencing us. So fundamentally, lots of things have changed. It's more difficult than it ever used to be. This is a piece of research that we think is really, really important for us to understand, both at a business level, but also at a personal level. And what you'll see there is that the biggest challenge that most organizations have, because there's so many people involved in making the decision, and I'd suggest the same is true if you're trying to persuade somebody to promote you or something like that, is actually agreeing on what the problem is. And actually then defining how to solve that problem. And we traditionally tend to think that our job is to make sure that we get selected as a supplier, make sure we get selected for that job. Whereas actually what the research is now saying very, very clearly is the more effort we put into the problem definition and the solution engineering piece and that piece, the more likely we are to succeed. So the traditional view of persuasion of, you've got this problem that maybe not that well defined, but I've got this fantastic solution, really doesn't work. This is another piece of research which actually comes from the same source as the previous slide, which is about how much contact people have with you before they how much research they do before they have real contact with you. Now, you can both look at Chris and I and work out that we're pretty old. When Chris and I started doing this, the vast majority of sales and persuasion conversations in the B2B environment happened face-to-face, lots and lots of contact. Not anymore. People out there are doing a lot of research online. So for the marketers, you know, that's a really, really important point, because it's so crucial that the online presence is right, is getting over the right messages. I know you all know that, but yeah, this is just such a crucial part of this whole journey. Now let's talk a bit more about persuasion. A lot of people think that logic is what you need to have in persuasion. And we don't disagree with that. We think logic is really, really important. The only problem is it's not enough on its own. Logic works if they're really prepared to listen, if they've clearly got an idea of what the situation is. And it will work if they're not too resistant to change. without logic, then you're going to have some problems with persuasion. So it's really important to have the evidence to support your logic. And what we see in practice is people think they're being logical, but they just don't. They don't build in the links. They don't show how they've got to where they've got to. The problem we have with logic isn't logic itself. It's the fact that a lot of decisions are made driven much more by emotion. And it would be lovely to be scientific about this and say 57% is emotional and 43% is logic. It's not as clear as that. We have to pay attention to the emotional side. We have to pay attention to the logical side as well. So just introduce you to a concept here about what we call our levers. Levers are all about trying to understand the negative levers are what might go wrong. The positive levers are, if you like, what's in it for you? What do you as an individual or your company gain from the idea, the solution? And secondary levers are ones that sit underneath those primary ones. So they support those negative and positive levers. So let's just think about some of the key messages we're saying about persuasion. You need to understand their positive and negatives. So if you like, what are they worrying about? What are their pain points? What are they looking to achieve? What are the consequences of not achieving what they're trying to achieve? What's going to be the impact of that problem continuing? So it's not as simple as just getting that first piece of input. You need to really get underneath the skin. And we talked here about pitch, and I always worry when I talk to marketeers about pitch, because I think, you know, we all have different ideas about what pitch means. To me, pitch can be a 3-line email or a 64-page PowerPoint pack. It's about tailoring your pitch to suit the audience. Again, I guess you all get that. But it's also about tailoring your pitch to fit their needs. I've got a really good example at the moment. I can't mention the company name, but we're talking to a fairly new startup, very, very, very well funded, doing some great tech. Our proposal to them is going to be probably maybe 4 lines on an email. It's all about pace, and it's also, but also for a small startup organization, they just want to get on and get things done. I'm worried now that you might have heard my message of saying logic doesn't matter. Logic does matter. You've got to make sure you've got logic in it. And it needs to be backed up with facts and return on investment. So logic is important, but we also need to make sure we understand the emotional side and use those levers as well. So this raises the question, well, what the hell can you actually do? So the first thing we want to say about being persuasive is this is all about asking questions. And you've probably all heard, you know, well, what sort of questions really work? And I bet you've heard open versus closed questions. You should ask open questions, yeah? You shouldn't ask closed questions. That's, yeah, that's one of the key messages that people are told. Unfortunately, the research doesn't actually back that up. So if you just pause for a second, if you imagine you meet somebody who's a raving extrovert, they just love talking. So that's probably me. Versus you meet an introvert who really finds it struggles to have that conversation. You probably don't want to be asking a raving extrovert lots of open questions. They talk too much anyway. So you want to be asking them closed questions that shut them up, or at least try. Whereas the introverts, you want to open them up. So you really need open questions to. So that's the problem, because you don't know what the psychological preferences are about the people you're meeting. if you're thinking about persuasion in the context of you and maybe your job environment, maybe you do know, and therefore you can do some different things. But what the research has found out is, and actually it's much more nuanced than that, the questions have to get at the levers. They have to get at what is it that really, really matters to that individual. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to hand over to Chris, who's going to talk much more about what this means in terms of negotiation and what it is the very best negotiators do. So over to you, Chris. Need to unmute yourself.
Yes, I know. I'm just doing that. Thank you, John. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for listening. So, clearly, what is the difference between persuasion and a negotiation? Well, persuasion really is just a very simple one-way process. It's about trying to persuade the people you are having a conversation with to move them to either accepting your solution, accepting your point of view, accepting your case. So it's very simple. It's you are persuading them to move to you. Now, negotiation, on the other hand, is very different. Negotiation is a two-way process. The whole definition of negotiation is you're trying to get a common agreement between two parties. So with negotiation, what we're trying to do is persuade, is get to a position where we both agree on something. So we both move to a point in the middle. Now, it goes without saying, you know, the very best negotiation is those that are a win-win. Now, I would suggest maybe look at some of the negotiation that's gone on in Brexit. Dare I raise that awful subject? But actually, you would say there may well have been some of the strategies that were being adopted by politicians on both sides was not a win-win strategy in their negotiation. It was a win-lose. I want my position and I don't care where you end up. But the research and everything about it tells you that the best negotiations are those that have a win-win, where both parties come out feeling that they've got something from that negotiation. Now, what can you negotiate on? Now, what do you think that you can negotiate on? Now, often I think the answer that initially people will come up with is dependent on whether they may be sitting in a marketing team or whether they're sitting in a business development role. And so there will be probably some subtle nuances that. But typically, when people are asked this question, and we run a course called on the effective negotiating skills, and we have a session on negotiating. What can you negotiate on? And very typically, the conversation will dry up fairly soon, and with people saying, do you know what, the only things we can negotiate on are price and time. And then with a little bit of persuasion, you might get resourcing out of that. And a little bit of persuasion, you might get some other topic that you think you can negotiate on. But actually, if you spend the time on it, there is an awful lot that you can negotiate on. When we've come back to this topic and in the course we run, we've got up to, with some facilitation, we've got up to over 130 items that people can have in their negotiation back pocket. So our experience and the very best and the research tells us that the best negotiators have a long list of things that they are going to negotiate on. And it is way more nuanced than just price, because you can cut price down into a whole variety, for example, of different items. So price, for example, could be, is it going to be time and materials? Is it going to be fixed priced? If it's fixed price, are we going milestones? And how are those milestones, what percentages are going to be split out on that? Are we going 30-day terms, or am I going to give you a discount if you pay in 7 days? Are you going to pay me in euros, or are you going to pay me in pounds? So you can start breaking price down into an awful lot of things. But the very best negotiators know not only the price of the item that they're going to negotiate on, but they have spent the time understanding the value of that item to their client. Because there isn't necessarily a correlation between price and value. Often something that is low cost to you could be seen as very high value to your client. So they spend time getting their list of negotiables out. They then spend time thinking about what the cost is to them and the value is to their client. And then the very best actually build their plan around those items. They will decide which sequence of things they're going to give away in that negotiation. And they will typically, the very best will start with giving away things that they believe will be perceived as high value for the client, but low cost to them. And then they'll work through their list as they progress through. They will not deliver all of the items in one go. They will go through, work through each one. So the very, very best work spend a lot of time thinking through what items then they're going to negotiate on. But that's all very well, very well and good, but negotiation really is a complex mix. And we do dive into this in a lot more detail typically. So I can only give you a very brief snapshot of it. As you'd have probably gathered from what I've just been saying, one of the things about negotiation is then one of the things we believe is absolutely critical before you get into actually having the conversation is preparation. Preparation can mean many things. It isn't just about what I was just talking through, identifying the list of negotiables. It's actually setting up the environment, maybe which you are going to negotiate in. Interestingly, one of the very best negotiations I ever had was with a tech company up in the East End of London. And the negotiation wasn't typical, as it most often is done, across the table, face to face. We sat on a squared sofa, and it interestingly changed the complete dynamics of the negotiation. It felt more like a conversation rather than a commercial negotiation. So the preparation isn't just about the things you're going to negotiate, it's about the environment that you're going to create to have that negotiation. I would suggest if you have to do it in an office, which we don't have to do it anymore, is if you do it that way, you sit across the corners of a table. But clearly, social distancing doesn't allow us to do that anymore. So preparation is really important. Interpersonal skills is the second most important thing in there. It's just understanding how you deliver the messages, how you maintain contact, how you maintain the environment in which you're having a conversation, rather than it feeling as if it's an attritional battle between two people. You want to try and create this environment and understand the interpersonal skills that enable it to be a win-win. One of the most key and most important skills that you need to learn to be a really good negotiator is listening. It's one of the skills we as humans are absolutely appalling at. We never listen properly. We never actually spend time honing our skills in listening, but is one of the most important things you need to get, we all need to get better at in negotiation, is really attentively listening to what the other side is saying and demonstrating back to them that you have actually listened, you have taken note, and you are acknowledging what they are saying. And the last bit in negotiation is all the various tactics that you are going to deploy and use to get the person to move from their position to closer to your position. And what are those tactics you're going to use? And we're not going to go into those now, but there's a whole list of different things you can do and things you can say and that you can nuance in there. One of the things we always say is, if you're going to give something away, always ask for something back in return. Otherwise, you'll always end up in a give-give situation. So always, when you've conceded something in a negotiation, ask the person you're having that conversation with, now what can you do in for return? So what are the negotiation behaviors that the best do? I can't even say it probably. Well, as John was saying, actually, you know, the very best don't negotiate unless they really have to. They spend their time persuading people to their point of view. They only negotiate if it's they really, really have to do that. The best people, as I said, persuade first. But too often in a negotiation, we concede far too early. An example it often might be that says, do you know, for this type of project, can you give me an idea of what the cost might be? And do you know what typically often the answer gets given is, well, actually, it could be between 25,000 and 60,000, depending. What number does the person you've just been speaking to remember? Is it the 60 or the 25? Actually, they've just remembered the 25. So as far as they're concerned, we're starting from negotiating at 25, not 60, whereas you thought you might be negotiating from 60. So be careful on the hints you give in terms of what concessions you are going to give. Be really confident about your position and be very clear about articulating your value. Concentrate the negotiation on the value you are delivering to your client and be very clear about how you articulate that. Don't talk about price. Talk about the value that your solution is going to deliver to that client. Why they should hire you as their new digital marketing manager. The value that you're going to bring, not the salary or the cost you're going to bring if you're a contractor or an employee. Don't start discounting too early. The best people to negotiate with are the car salesmen. They'll offer you a discount straight away, and I'm sure they'll offer even bigger discounts now. So you can always negotiate with car salesmen. They'll always start at 20%. And the worst people than them are software salespeople, especially at the end of their quarter or at the end of their half year. They will always be offering discounts. And the last thought I'll leave you with is to be really good at negotiation, spend the time preparing first. Really spend the time trying to get in, putting yourself in the shoes of your customer or your manager or your agency to really understand what the value of your negotiables are. Concentrate on the value, not on the cost. Do those few things, and I think you can improve the outcomes of your negotiations. Over to you, John. Oh, it's actually, well, it's for both of us to say.
I'm going to stop sharing and go to Joe.
Sweet. Thank you very much, chaps. So just to say that mindset shift for me, when you first say about persuasion first, negotiation second, but then also the list of the negotiables for you. They're two of the things which I listened to that talk for the first time and I came away and it changed how I approach business. So I want to say thank you to both of you for taking the time to deliver that, because there's still a whole bunch of people on this chat who would no doubt have benefited from that little grain of knowledge and so much more from that presentation. So thank you both. It's really, really useful. There have been a series of questions that have come in. What I'll say to everyone else on the call still is take the time to ask a question. We've got a little bit of time. I've got some of my own. If you wiggle your mouse, you'll find the Q&A feature below and you can get your questions in. I'm literally going to be taking them from the top. So we've got a question from Marguerite, who says, and it's very relevant for today as well with the situation as we addressed it at the beginning, which says, as a Black woman, the statistics say that as a group, we will earn 68% of the salary a white male will do in the same job. Can these persuasion tools work even if an employer has an inherent bias? And I guess the particular element that's really worth noting there is the inherent bias bit. because I guess the rest of it, yeah. So yeah, we'll start with that if that's okay.
Okay, I'll kick off and then maybe Chris will chip in. Look, I think the answer yeah is yes, but let's be frank, it's much more difficult when you're trying to persuade somebody who's got a degree of bias in the situation you're talking about. I think the key thing to really, really focus on is the value that you can create, the outputs that you can deliver. And funnily enough, having said what I did say a few minutes ago, I think it's more, even more important when there's that bias to get as much logic in as you can. So a really strong rationale. The thing that worries me about any of those sorts of conversations is we weave in a lot of our own emotion into them, and we need to take that out, and we need to help the person on the other side take that out. So we've got a really strong like business case about why they should promote you. That can only really work if you've got some strong value you've delivered. So I do a lot of coaching work, and one of the key things I say in that is build your story of the value, document it, and take time to do that so it's thorough and it's rigorous. I think that's what I'd say. Chris, what are your thoughts?
The only thing, well, I think it's very hard to persuade someone who has an inherent bias. And quite frankly, I wouldn't work with anyone if they are making decisions based on race, because that's completely unacceptable to me. But that's me saying that. I would base it on value, and I would use, using John's analogy of stories, I would call it case studies or evidence of past things I have done and the value I've delivered to the clients I've worked in the past to demonstrate why I would be the right person to come in and undertake that role.
No, can I just add in another point? Because in the B2B environment, in sales and when we're helping people, we do come across a different sort of bias. And one of the key things that we coach people to is sometimes you've got to walk away. And, you know, I think, you know, we none of us should ever forget that's always an option for us.
Yeah.
Thank you. So actually, one of the things that came up in the presentation was listening. And I'm not going to go to the top question here, because there's one from Orion, which I really like, which is just simply, it is an open question. It says, how can we listen better? Do you have any particular techniques for listening better?
As I said in the talk, it's a skill we as people aren't very good at. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of studies have been done that, you know, we start by not having an open mind to listen to what someone's saying. So we're already filtering, because we've already got, we know we're going to this negotiation to achieve this. So I've already set an agenda in my mind. So I'm filtering out already anything else that's being said to me, because that's not on the agenda that I've said. So that's number one. Two is in a negotiation, or how you listen better, is try and cut out all the other distractions that are happening around you. How often have you sat in a room on maybe the third or fourth floor with a nice big glass window? Someone's been having a conversation, you've looked out there because the car has just reversed into the lamppost. And you come back from looking out of the window, watching that car, and go, ha ha, what an idiot. I can't imagine how he did that. And you come back to the conversation and go, what were we talking about? So that's those types of things. And it's other simple things, like in a negotiation or a conversation, how many times do people pick up their phone? To me, that's also very annoying. It shows a level of disrespect, I think. So one of the other things, put your phone away. Just turn it off. Mm-hmm. Move as many distractions away from you as possible so that you can actually concentrate on the conversation. And if you can concentrate on that conversation, I'm sure you'll get a better outcome. That's brilliant. It comes with practice and it comes with discipline.
Just Absolutely. And I guess there's an element of that which could also come in. You mentioned designing the environment for negotiation.
Absolutely, yeah. As I said, I've done very structured negotiations where it is face-to-face.
Yeah.
You're one side of the table, someone's the other side of the table, and you know that is going to be a confrontational negotiation. Yeah. Others, it's been in a much more relaxed environment. And as I said, just sitting on a sofa, it sounds so bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting on a sofa and having a negotiation completely changed the dynamics. I couldn't believe it. It ended up like a conversation. We were, as a team,
mm-hmm.
trying to focus on solving a problem.
That's brilliant.
Interesting. Tracy's just put a very nice quick post up. Listen to understand, not to fix things.
Correct.
And one of the challenges I used to have when I was younger is that I thought I was a great listener. And actually, I was pretty crap. And I made myself write notes. And I found that meant that I listened much more carefully. I find it quite fascinating. I spend quite a bit of my time watching people having these sorts of persuasive conversations or having negotiations. And we come out and we do a review. And they've got 3 lines on their notepad. I've got 7 pages.
Yep.
So, but my fundamental question is, how well have you been listening?
But Bill, just building on that, the fact that you are taking notes, I think demonstrates to the person you're having a conversation with that you are taking this conversation seriously. Mm-hmm. If you sit there with just a blank sheet of paper or don't even open a notebook, you go, are you really listening to anything I'm saying? And how are you going to recall all the things we have agreed to do during this conversation if you're not taking notes?
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to prove here.
Yeah. and I noticed someone came put it up there and on the chat thing, and I'll just say this, is when I first started out, my sales manager said to me, you need to be Mickey Mouse. I said, what do you mean by Mickey Mouse? He said, 2 ears, 2 eyes, 1 mouth, use them in that proportion. The best salespeople don't speak a lot. They listen best.
I love that. Okay, we'll go to the next question. We'll do Deborah's next, but I've got one quick one first, which is, if you imagine the scene, you walk into the room and there's a person in front of you. They're sat the other side of the desk, or in the virtual world, they've been very short on their emails back to you. You've tried to be very friendly. You walk in and you feel like the underdog. In this scenario, you feel like, I don't know how to deal with this person. How do you begin to A, find the confidence, B, start to feel permission to persuade, and then C, if you have to negotiate, if you feel like the underdog?
I think there's 3 things. One, do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
I think confidence and people undermining our confidence, sometimes we don't help ourselves by doing the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also the thing about courage. And if you have been treated as in the way that you've just described it, Joe, is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say this, but I think there's some organizations that think that is okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd want to be working with them or for them. But I think fundamentally, this is about you being ready to have the conversation. I've worked with people where we've said they're not ready,
mm-hmm.
and they deliberately engineer not having the conversation. Now you might say that's ducking the responsibility, but I think it's about getting yourself as ready as you possibly can. One of the things I tend to do if I get I work with some people who send very short, curt emails, and that's fine, that's how they are and who they are. But if I get a really short, curt email from somebody who doesn't normally do that, my response is there something wrong?
Right. Nice. So the proactivity.
Call it out.
Nice. I love that. Catches
added a comment. Well, if they're more formal, like finance and lawyers, etc. Yeah, they're still human beings, Catcher. Not all of them. But yeah. So we do a lot of work with senior lawyers and senior accountants. And a lot of people who've got those high technical skills and high intellectual skills do put up a little bit of a facade, put up a bit of a veneer. And I think if we can find some ways through that, so that preparation I talk about isn't just about the logical side, it's also about the emotional side.
Lovely. Thank you very much. So we've got 10 minutes left, so we'll make these open 8 questions into a quick fire round, if you don't mind. So we've got a question from Deborah, and I feel like you would have covered a lot of these elements within the presentation, but potentially we can now apply these to a specific scenario. So Deborah says, how can we persuade a client that despite our product being more expensive than other quotes, they may have found for similar products that they are the worthy choice, particularly given the current climate where budgets will be so tight for companies and decision makers will be seeing the pounds before anything?
Simple, focus on the value you deliver, not on the price.
Nice.
and when it's, and I say value, be able to articulate that in pound, in monetary value.
I think right now, the market, particularly for agencies, is really, really tough. Let's not pretend. And there's a lot of freelancers out there, some really good quality people who unfortunately don't have jobs. So it's going to be challenging. So you've got to be much more articulate about the value you can create. And I'm going to be really horrible here. Value has to have a pound note or a dollar or a euro next to it. So you've got to work out how to monetize what you're saying you can deliver. But I think also maybe have the courage to monetize what the opposition is going to deliver and see where the difference is.
Nice, good call. No, I like that. Yeah, particularly if you know who that opposition is. Competition. So we've got a question from Anonymous. So they're very mysterious here, unless they are called Anonymous attendee.
Could be.
They say, what would you say is a good strategy for getting past gatekeepers when cold calling or cold visiting? Thank you very much for doing this.
You go first, Chris. You know what I think.
I think the best way to getting to do cold calling is you have to warn them up, first of all, with an email, letter, or something that warns them that you are going to be calling. I think straight cold calling on the phone without any warm-up activity doesn't work.
Yeah, and I'm going to say the same thing. Is it's cold calling, the evidence is that absolutely cold calling doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I think, really strange thing, send people a letter. How many of you get a letter these days?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of
that. I agree. I think as we're now all working from home, letters is a great thing to do.
So yeah. A well-written letter that sells the need for a conversation. And marketers out there, you know, I think sometimes maybe we forget that what is the purpose of what we're doing. So the purpose of a cold call, not a cold call, hopefully a warm call, is to sell the need to have a conversation, to persuade somebody to have a conversation, not to persuade them to take a product or a service.
That's a really good point. That's a snippet right there. I like that. we've got a question from Yves. So we do have a question specifically about negotiating on interviews, but I feel like we've kind of covered that. So unless John...
Before you do skip over that one, Joe, I think, again, do your preparation, your research, you know, really understand what the market's like for that particular job role. You know, how many people are out there, and it's pretty easy data to get these days.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The preparation is absolutely vital. And like, if there's one thing to take away from here, that could well be it. So we've got a question from Yves. Do you have a checklist or template for the preparation phase?
Yes and no. Sorry. Okay. I think for preparing on a negotiation, the key piece of preparation is really thinking in depth about all of the things you can negotiate on. And then putting that list together and working out what's the value to you what's the cost to you, what's the value to the client, or the other side. And it takes time and effort. And as Chris says, you know, we do this work both in terms of running training courses, but also with coaching real life situations. As I'm saying this, I'm thinking of one particular situation where they said there's only four things we can negotiate on. When we actually sat down and worked it all through, there was something like 80 things they could negotiate on. And that was a really interesting example where they knew who the competition was. It was an open competition. They had a killer question that they knew if they asked the customer that question, it would blow the competition out of the water. They wanted to ask it. The negotiation for this particular project lasted a week. They wanted to ask that question on the Monday morning.
Okay.
Our counsel was to, no, ask it on Friday morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you ask it on Monday, the competition have got enough time to maybe work out an answer. So I think it would be very easy to say there is a checklist. Mm-hmm. I think the reality is the detail will vary from time to time. It is about quantity and then honing that down to the quality of where is the real value you can create.
I love that. And if there's a point here, there's a few questions coming in which are like quite specific questions, but if there's one message that seems to be reoccurring again and again, it's like preparation for the individual that you're going to be persuading and negotiating. It's not a one size fits all approach. It's a very much.
If there's any of those individual questions that we don't get through tonight, just find Chris or I on LinkedIn. Drop us a note. We're more than happy to engage in that conversation with you.
Absolutely, and I'll link it in the follow up. So another question from Anonymous. So how can you approach potential prospects either in the B2C or B2B environments who are searching for your marketing services? I don't think I read that question quite right. I think there might be a better place to answer that question. So we'll come back to that one if possible. So there's a question here which says, how do you classify as levers are primary, positive or negative, and secondary? So I think that's more of a reiteration of the presentation and maybe some examples if you could.
Let me reinforce that. So I think primary levers, the simple way of explaining that is primary levers are things that really matter to your customer, to your client. But underneath them, there are going to be some knock-on effects, positive or negative, which we would call secondary levers. What you're trying to do is get as many of those as possible because that reinforces your case for change. And I think one of the things we find that really effective people do is they think about persuasion as building a case for change. And the more things you can have, it's not unlike what Chris has said about negotiation, the more reasons you can have for changing, positive and negative, it's important to have some degree of balance between the problems that need fixing and what will happen if you don't fix the problems versus the opportunities that can be grabbed and the payoff you get from those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the more levers, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what do the best people do? They really think very carefully about which of those levers matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I will find myself saying to a client, you've given me seven things that you're really worried about. Which is the most important one?
Mm-hmm.
If you only could afford to fix one, which one would it be? So I'm trying to get them to prioritize for me.
Yeah, I love that. No, very good. Okay, so last question, I reckon, which again comes from Anonymous, who says, how important is storytelling when negotiating? And how do you then build that in?
That's a very interesting question, and I did see that, and I was wondering whether you're going to ask it. I think storytelling is important in both persuasion and negotiation. Mm-hmm. It's not, you don't use it in one or the other. I think it's a very powerful tool to use in negotiation. To demonstrate your understanding of the client's pain points that you are trying to address, And equally demonstrating, if you can tell a story as to how you have solved that somewhere else that is relevant to them and the value that you've delivered in solving that to someone else. So I think storytelling is really important, and I think it's important to have a number of stories in your armory that you can roll out in the conversation you're having. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's very important.
Let me quickly echo that. It's got to be relevant. The one thing that worries me whenever we talk about storytelling is the relevance of the story to the situation you're in.
Must be relevant.
Yeah. Nice. Fab. And do you have any examples of like the types of stories that you tell? Is there, again, it's not going to be a one size fits all, I appreciate, but is there going to be?
So I have a bank of stories, which mm-hmm. are all about situations where we've come across a particular problem or a particular opportunity, mm-hmm. and how that client, and the emphasis is really important, how that client has solved it. Mm-hmm. So often it's not what we've done.
Yeah.
It's more often what we've helped the client do. So we very deliberately try and keep ourselves in the background. Mm-hmm. And we think that's a really important part of how you tell. If you claim all the credit, yeah. people don't believe you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's not the truth of the matter. You know, if you're trying to persuade an organization or an individual, it is a two-way process. You can't do it on your own.
And most people don't want to be the first. Most organizations don't want to be the first to buy this solution, mm-hmm. hire this person or whatever. Mm-hmm. They want to know, where have you done it before, what you've delivered, mm-hmm. and that makes them more comfortable, because most organizations are on the conservative end of the spectrum. So if you can tell them a story as to where it's been done before, where you've seen that problem before, how you've helped the client solve it, and the value they've got from it, bingo.
Nice. So a case study approach, basically.
Yes.
Lovely. Fabulous. Well, so we have touched our hour mark. So I think it's very important that we allow people to head into their evenings and enjoy the last of the sunshine, because I think it's supposed to be the last day today. So all I can say is thank you very, very much to Chris and to John for spending the time with us tonight. I hope people have found that really useful. Even the second time round, I've taken an awful lot from it, which I'll be presenting and using in so many different ways. Couple of things as to follow up. Please do say thank you to the sponsors. And if you're interested in finding out more, then we are running the workshop in a few weeks' time, which will go into more depth on the topics that we've discussed tonight. As ever, you know, like, this community is just like the best community in the world. You're absolutely brilliant, and Chris and John, you've both embodied that tonight. So thank you very much, and thank you to everyone that's been here as well. Take care, look after yourselves, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
The same from us. Thank you.
Yeah. Take care. Have a lovely evening, everyone.
Take care. Bye.